Snape and the Malfoys, an essay written by Drinking Coco and read by Jocunda Sykes. Summary. Lucius Malfoy's lapdog, Draco's favourite teacher. Narcissus' bonded co-conspirator against the Dark Lord. What is Snape's relationship to the Malfoys? Through considering plot points such as Snape's sorting, Draco's defence against the dark arts training, and Snape's unbreakable vow with Narcissa, we examine Snape's interactions with this complex family. Whether they oppose Snape, support him, or only think they support him, their friendship is a source of life or death strength to them all. This was presented at Mysticon on the 10th of May 2013, and recorded in September 2021. The relationship between Snape and the Malfoys is a deliciously complex one, in which they're sometimes on the same side, sometimes opposite sides, and sometimes no sides at all. It's the story of the making of a teacher, a flawed man who helped a flawed student do better than he did, a conscientious man who recognised and responded to the love he saw, even between people who committed monstrous crimes that are secretly abhorred. Snape saved the Malfoys' lives. The Malfoys made his life worth living. We see that there's already a history from the first day of potions class, when Draco, Crabbe and Goyle shake with laughter as Snape picks on famous Harry Potter. Snape must have talked with Slytherins about Potter already. Snape looks at Draco when mentioning students with an aptitude for potions. He's clearly known Draco from outside of school, well enough to discuss potions with him. We learn that Snape has earned a reputation for favouring Slytherin and has guided Slytherin to the House Cup victory for the past 6 years. A streak that provokes unanimous resentment from the other three houses. Finally, we have Hagrid's unchallenged statement that all bad witches and wizards come from Slytherin, an untruth that conveys accurately the anti-Slytherin sentiment of 1991 Hogwarts. These details bring to life how it must have felt to be sorted into Slytherin in the hiatus after Voldemort's first defeat, when the deaths and disappearances were so fresh that people were still terrified to say his name. Many Death Eaters did, in fact, come from Slytherin. There must have been vast hostility towards children of Death Eaters and even their blameless associates. Slytherin parents must have been frightened to entrust their 11-year-olds to this school. We learn in Book 4 that Narcissa and Lucius had a discussion about whether to send Draco to Hogwarts at all. "Father actually considered sending me to Durmstrang rather than Hogwarts, you know. He knows the headmaster, you see. Well, you know his opinion of Dumbledore, the man's such a mudbud lover. And Durmstrang doesn't admit that sort of riffraff. But Mother didn't like the idea of me going to school so far away. Father says Durmstrang takes a far more sensible line than Hogwarts about the dark arts. Durmstrang students actually learn them, not just the defence rubbish we do." It's an intimate view into the Malfoy parenting process. The Malfoys are a functional family. The parents communicate, sometimes disagree, care for their young, inform their child of some decisions and keep others private. They also shield Draco from some of their adult business, keeping him innocent. In Chamber of Secrets, Draco doesn't know the dangerous errands his father is running at Borgin and Burke's, or Flourish and Blotts. He just bugs his preoccupied father to buy him a present. Lucius is trying to distance himself from his Death Eater past. So why would he reinforce ties with the Death Eater by sending Draco to Durmstrang? Perhaps there was more to the family discussion than Draco was told. Lucius and Narcissa may have worried about sending their child to a school where unfairness to Slytherins was tacitly permitted or condoned. It seems likely that the Malfoys met privately with Snape to assure themselves that he would advocate strongly enough for Slytherin. Perhaps these concerns were also what spurred Lucius to join the Hogwarts Board of Governors. No wonder Snape was invested in Slytherin winning the House Cup and the Quidditch Cup. As head of Slytherin, it seems logical that this was part of Snape's strategy to strengthen morale and reassure anxious parents that he would be vigilant about protecting Slytherin's rights. A 6-year winning streak is an extraordinary achievement, especially considering the point system seems to operate subjectively, even capriciously, with no guidelines. The Slytherins clearly knew that the stakes were high. According to Fanon, Snape was a regular at Malfoy Manor during Draco's childhood, perhaps even Draco's godfather. That seems less likely to me. After Voldemort's disappearance, Lucius would have had no reason to retain regular contact with Snape, who had little power, unlike the politicians Lucius cultivated. It seems unlikely that the Malfoys would have conferred godfather status on an impoverished, unconnected half-blood who lived in, as Bellatrix said, a muggle dunghill. Snape was not influential at the time Draco was born. He was just a 21-year-old junior spy, not yet a teacher, and therefore lacking the access to information on Dumbledore and Harry that would later, upon Voldemort's return, promote him to Voldemort's inner circle. The Malfoys would not have seen him, at the time, as a candidate for raising Draco. So how did the Malfoys view Snape when he was younger? From the Prince's tale, we have the surprising but crucial detail that Lucius, as Slytherin prefect, welcomed the poor, unattractive, just-sorted child with a pat on the back. That welcoming gesture functioned as a sort of protective magic spell for Child Snape, granting him an indelible rush of belonging and a gladness at a critical moment that he would forever associate with Lucius Malfoy, even after witnessing unspeakable evil from Lucius. Snape, who gave his entire adult life to fighting against Lucius's creed, never stopped relating to him as a person, never withdrew his protection of Lucius's loved ones. Just as Sirius Black's initial jeering at Snape created a lifelong enmity, just as Harry sparing Wormtail's life had long-lasting effects, so did this single act of kindness at the right moment create a visceral bond so that Snape never fully shut out Lucius Malfoy. We know that first-year Snape knew as many curses as most seventh years. We know that Sirius mocked Snape as Lucius Malfoy's lapdog. It seems likely that Lucius was impressed and amused by the unpopular little prodigy and tolerated hero worship from 11-year-old Snape following him around Hogwarts. Surely it mattered to Snape that Lucius appreciated him for his abilities. Everyone important to Snape, from his mother to Lucius to Lily Evans, had that in common. That they saw past the superficial to recognise his pure love for magic. There is not a word in the series about what Snape thought of the Malfoys' contempt for poor people, half-bloods, or wizards of no pedigree. But Rowling lets us know, with her emphasis on these themes, that Snape is well aware of the Malfoy attitude towards everything he is, even as they befriend him and assume that he shares their worldview. He cannot miss the irony that they despise his kind and yet associate with him, not bothering to resolve the contradictions in their own attitudes, too narcissistic for their acceptance of Snape even to register in their own minds as tokenism. In short, it is the same fallacy that enabled student Snape to court Lily Evans and yet aspire to be a Death Eater. As a double agent, Snape must permit the Malfoys' nonsense to pass unchallenged, but the unthinking way they treat him as an exception is reminiscent of teen Lily pointing out, "But you call everyone of my birth mudblood Severus. Why should I be any different?" But then Draco turns 11, and the Malfoys need him. After Voldemort disappears, the former lapdog has a new power base. He's a head of house and an advocate. He remembers how it felt to be ostracised as a Slytherin. He also remembers how it was to be considered unpromising, creepy, and given no chance. We see Harry treated that way by Aunt Marge, assumed bad because she thought his parents were bad. We see Hagrid bias Harry against Slytherin that way, although it must be said that Draco didn't help with his comments about his servants, the right kind of people, and his intention to bully his father for presents. Draco arrives at Hogwarts already insufferable. And it is because of this, not in spite of it, that Snape feels inclined to reach out to him. Lucius Malfoy is the only elder we see reach out to ugly, repellent Snape when he was a kid. Dumbledore didn't. Slughorn didn't. Snape doesn't want anyone to repeat the mistakes he made as a child who was stigmatised as creepy. He doesn't believe Draco will inevitably become evil. It is a tricky, covert act for a teacher to try to teach Draco his own values whilst not antagonising the parents and still assuring them that their child is in good hands, turning him away from his parents' values undetected. A look at Snape's behaviour around perceived or real bias against Slytherins shows that his role as Slytherin advocate and protector was vitally important to him, perhaps the most important part of his job. The essay now says that he was 23 when he took the post of Potions Master, but this is Jock here to say that I think he was 21. So he was, 21 when he took the post. His memory of the Marauder's prank and Dumbledore's response was still fresh. We see his rage when Dumbledore taunts Slytherin unnecessarily whilst awarding the House Cup in Book One. His job had just got infinitely harder. Until then, it was going to have been a party in the Slytherin common room, his seventh year of a job well done. Now he's going to have to lead a group counselling session as his outraged, disbelieving students wonder why everyone hates them and why the headmaster thinks this is okay. We know McGonagall rarely comes into the Gryffindor common room, but it is easy to imagine that Snape rallied his Slytherins much more frequently. We know from Book 6 that under Snape's leadership, Slytherins believed in resolving matters internally without involving Dumbledore. When Snape scolds Draco for missing appointments, and Draco retorts that he can give detention or report Draco to Dumbledore, Snape says, "You know perfectly well that I do not wish to do either of those things." That was in The Half-Blood Prince. It seems overkill for Lucius to buy Nimbus 2001s for the whole team in Book 2, until we recall how it must have looked to the Slytherins when Dumbledore authorised a rule exception for Harry to play in his first year, and, provided unasked, a school-funded brim. From that perspective, Lucius was just a parent doing his best to offset the school's institutional bias. Snape is in accord, as we see from his overriding Gryffindor's claim to the Quidditch pitch. He and Lucius have discussed this. One of Snape's most disgraceful moments comes in Goblet of Fire, when he says of Hermione's hexed teeth, "I see no difference." Rowling misdirected me successfully for years about what spurred his petulance. Is he just a Gryffindor-hating bully? Is he jumpy because Moody scares him? Or because his dark mark is coming back? Does Hermione annoy him? It wasn't until I reread the series for this talk that I realised, in an immature and shamefully misdirected way, that shows how powerless he feels, that he's retaliating for Draco being transfigured and beaten by a teacher, for the anguish of failing to protect Draco from being tortured by someone he believes to be an anti-Slytherin aura. Snape's tolerance towards Draco is tested in Book 2, though, when he overhears Draco in potions class, wishing death on Muggle Borns. In one of Rowling's masterfully infinitesimal fissures in her narrative, she shows the single instance in all 7 books when the public, Snape, betrays his revulsion at bigotry and declines to defend Draco against Gryffindor aggression. Blink and you'll miss it. She signals it only by a shift from active to passive voice. "I'm quite surprised the Mudbloods haven't all packed their bags by now," Malfoy went on. "Bet you 5 galleons the next one dies. Pity it wasn't Granger." The bell rang at that moment, which was lucky. At Malfoy's last words, Ron had leapt off his stool, and in the scramble to collect bags and books, his attempts to reach Malfoy went unnoticed. Now, since when does Snape not notice a Gryffindor attack? No wonder Snape went to so much trouble to drill Expelliarmus into both Harry and Draco, ensuring that the boys performed it under conditions of maximum hostility by pairing them up against each other. He had to do what he could to keep Muggle-borns and their friends safe from Draco, whilst still protecting Draco himself. At the end of Goblet of Fire, Harry mentions Lucius Malfoy as one of the returning Death Eaters, and Snape makes a sudden movement. Knowing Lucius as he does, he knows his job protecting Draco just got harder. Lucius and several other Death Eaters go to prison at the end of Book 5. Draco, Crabbe and Goyle look stricken when Harry mentions Voldemort's name, showing that their fathers had not prepared them for life as the sons of Death Eaters. As Dumbledore knows from experience, the rage and grief of losing a parent to prison can make a person dangerously unstable. These students need Snape's guidance more than ever. We get a glimpse of his determination to provide it in Book 6, when Hermione says people who fail their OWLs must talk to the head of house, and we then see Snape telling Draco to warn Crabbe and Goyle that they must work harder if they intend to pass potions on their second try. As if Snape didn't have enough to worry about, what with occluding Voldemort, killing Dumbledore, not killing Harry, and tracking Draco's murder attempts. But he takes his duties seriously. All of them. All things Malfoy come to a head for Snape in Book 6, Half-Blood Prince. After years of protecting Harry, whom he loathes, in memory of Snape's mother, Snape is given a miracle. Perhaps the single mercy his author grants Snape in his relentless life. He gets a second chance. He gets to protect a child he actually likes at the request of a mother who is actually alive to thank him, who chose Snape for his true self, for the best in him, for his unique abilities to protect people from Voldemort without Voldemort knowing, for the respect and regard he's earned from Draco over years of faithful teaching. The gift Narcissa Malfoy gives Snape with the unbreakable vow is beyond measure. Until that vow, everything Snape did in his life depended on his willpower alone. There was nobody to whom Snape was truly indispensable. Nobody to care whether he lived or died. With her request, Snape becomes the most important person in the world to someone, the person on whom somebody's life depends. At last, he has something to make his work easier, a vital and mortal connection. Narcissa's request anchors him. She asks him not because he is family to Draco, not a friend, not a surrogate father, but a teacher. She recognises in him an identity that is equal in weight to wealth, to blood, to anything else the Malfoys revere. Few moments in the series are as starkly beautiful as the tableau of Snape singing shut Draco's septum sempra wounds, performing magic that nobody else in the world could cast, suffusing the song with all his grief and regrets that evil he unleashed when he was a child is still doing harm in the world, still hurting this child who has spent all year trying to kill people, and yet doesn't deserve this because nobody deserves this. Draco has been pushing Snape away all year, descending deeper into horror, yet when he is in danger, Snape's protective response is absolute. I came here as soon as I could. You'll be all right. I've got you. I'm here. This is a merciful gift to Snape. The more he protects someone out of genuine care, the easier it will be for the same protection to flow from him when he must work with Harry, whom he does not love, and never will. And then Draco beats Dumbledore not with aggression but with Expelliarmus. This is the glorious validation of all the nurturing that Snape has poured into this kid who stands for everything Snape is fighting to dismantle. This is a better result than Dumbledore foresaw from Draco, perhaps better than Snape foresaw. So Draco had been listening after all. And in return, he received a magical protection greater than he could have foreseen. He learnt that Dumbledore thought him worth saving, so much so that he died to keep Draco and his family alive. He learnt that Snape vowed either to die for him or to split his own soul by killing for Draco, and then to undergo the near-fatal agony of remorse in order to reintegrate his soul after that act, knowing that Draco was too innocent to know how to do so, and undertaking the ordeal in Draco's stead. This act of reintegration, the remorse Snape experienced on the floor of Sirius Black's bedroom, no longer denying the enormity of what he had done to Harry by betraying Lily, was the magic that gave Snape the integrity to face his final, brutal year. He could not have done it for Harry's sake. He and Harry had no bond. He could only generate the emotion for true remorse by knowing that everything he did would also help him protect those for whom he truly cared. No matter how often Snape and the Malfoys were at odds, no matter how much evil they committed between them, from the first moment they met, there was a genuine bond. It was this bond that saved Draco's life, that spared Lucius's and Narcissa's lives, and that enabled Snape to save his own soul.